length of the weight arm over the length of the power arm gives you the amount of advantage that you have in using the lever. Which means that the long, well, first of all, let me tell you what a weight arm is and what a power arm is. You should do that. Let's work on this more simple lever. The distance from the perpendicular application of the weight, which would be here in this case, to the fulcrum is the weight arm, which we'll call WA. And by the same token, the length of where the power is applied, from where the power is applied perpendicularly to the fulcrum, is the power arm. So the formula is saying that the longer the power arm is in relation to the weight arm, the more mechanical advantage you have. For instance, big one.
The longer the power arm is,
You know that already. Before I came here this morning, you knew that. Because we do this all day long. For instance, let's go back to the time that we were children and we played on the seesaw. If on the seesaw the kid on the other side is heavier than you, what kind of an adjustment could you make? Well, without using more power, what did you do? Beg your pardon? And why did you do that? Yeah, and in terms of what I just told you, why did you do that?
Because he's got more power than he's shortening his power arm.
Precisely. Which balances out your less weight. With a longer power arm, you can balance him out. As I say, you know this already. This is just the way it's codified in physics so that we can work with it in the laboratory. But that's all that is to that. And so that... In other words, you know that because if you want to pry a rock up or a heavy weight, you know that the longer the stick you use to do that, the easier it is to do that. You always get a longer power arm. Archimedes, the great Greek philosopher, said, "Give me a lever long enough and I'll move the earth." Didn't say what he's going to use for a fulcrum, but move it around maybe, I don't know. So that's what that's all about. Now, that leverage effect, as we've been talking about it from the standpoint of a power arm, also is true with the weight arm. So that if the weight is very far out, that means you've got to use more power or increase the length of your power arm to balance it out or to move the weight. So it can work both to your detriment and to your benefit. That's the reason we want to get the weights as close to the central axis as the structure permits. Because you could think of it in terms of getting your weights back closer to the fulcrum. So you don't have to compensate with extra muscle work to keep the system in balance. And in a few minutes, after we do a couple of little simple exercises here, we're going to practice doing that same thing with outside weights. It's not only the weights of your structure that you want to keep close to your central axis, but anything that you lift, the same principle. We'll work on that in just a minute or so, maybe a little longer than that. But now what I want to do is to go back to that central axis, which we're going to be relating to, and work with it for just a few moments. And this is where we'll start. You can put your papers away for a moment, just down by your side somewhere. And will you now imagine that you are a rag doll, completely devoid of any kind of compression member that could keep you upright. And as the rag doll, let yourself collapse totally. Okay, Now, will you just stay in that position for a few moments and get the feel of what it's like? Enjoy it. You've been wanting to do that probably in class since we started using the benches. This is your opportunity. Now, as you are enjoying that feeling of being the ragdoll, will you image a central axis through the ragdoll following the contours of the way you are folded up or collapsed or whatever? The axis is not straight, it follows the contours of your body. And now, would you image the central axis coming up to a vertical position, and the rest of you still being ragdoll, just hanging around the central axis? And as you visualize that, follow that with the movement, that is, the axis coming up to a straight vertical position. Remembering all the time that all of you is still ragdoll except the one central axis. That's the only thing that has any substance. There's nothing that is supportive except the central axis in your image. And everything hangs around that central axis. Only the central axis. Everything else is ragdoll. That is a very good way to develop a sense of the central axis, and it also, again, releases a lot of the superficial tension in the body, getting you into the deeper muscles of the body as you visualize that central axis. Another way to utilize that principle. Now, while we are sitting here, let's just review some of the sitting principles rather quickly as we move on to other material. Just do your little forward rock for a moment. And as you rock forward, let the heads of the femur bones extend into the thigh sockets. And the knee ends of the femur bones extend out into space. Now you have something to add to that. The spine lengthening every time you do the flexion. You could do it on the flexion or the extension, but that's particularly worth on the flexion. As you go forward, and as the knees release, the spine releases. The two go together. You really can't lengthen your spine if you're tightening your knees. Hard to do that. So you might begin to think of those two together. As you let the knees extend, let the spine lengthen. Okay. Now just balance on the sit bones for a moment. Your head is between them. And let's just touch the thigh creases here and watch the femur head sinking in the thigh creases. Like little golf balls in the golf cup. And the great trochanter is melting down the sides of the legs as you sit. And then leaving the tactylate on one thigh crease, take the opposite eye and put your hand over the eye and then part of the fingers of the hand on the side there, the temple around there. Let the eye center in its socket as the side of the head softens, melts down. then take the opposite eye socket and eye socket, the same thing. Just let the femur head sink into the acetabulum and think of the eye sinking into the eye socket. The side there of the skull around the temple melting, softening. Then once again, just think of your balance on your femur, on your sit bones, tuberosities of the ischia, and just a little bit of the forward rock here, just to get that sense of balance, easy. Now we need to add something else. It's very important. In the standing position, it is important that the three leg joints be in the same sagittal plane. That is to say, a sagittal plane passing through the center of any one of the three leg joints, the ankle, the knee, or the femora, should pass through the center of all of them. This is because the knee joint especially, and the ankle joint to a certain extent, do not have much lateral possibility of movement. And if you put a lateral stress on the knee joint, you will tend to stress the soft tissue around the joint. So when you are standing, a good rule to follow, we'll get up in just a minute and do that together, is that you want the knee approximately over the second toe. In the foot, the second toe is the central axial toe of the foot, which is comparable to the third finger in the hand. And it's that second toe that we want to relate to the knee. It's one way to help keep those joints in alignment. Now, that is not, again, an absolute, because some of you are probably going to want to come a little bit in of that second toe, and some maybe even a little out. But you should be somewhere in the neighborhood of the second toe, not get too far away from it. Because lateral stress on the knee can, again, actually over a long period of time, set the knee up for an injury. If you stretch those ligaments in the knee, they are what are called inelastic. And they don't come back to their normal length if they're stretched over a long period of time. They just get longer and longer. And while you may get more movement at the knee joint, more range from that, the knee joint is permitted to move into a range that is beyond what it should, and the possibility of damage to the knee joint is set up. So let's practice the line of movement from the centers of the knees to the center of the acetabula. Then, after you've done that, let's extend the line from the knees down over the ankles and then through the foot, through the second toes. And then come back up through the second toes, foot, knees, and into the acetabula. Now that is true whether or not you are working with your feet parallel or whether you're working in a turnout position. Either way, because you see the turnout, if it's done well, is done at the iliofemoral joint here. You've rotated this out so that you still can have the knee going over the second toe, no matter whether you're working in second position or the turnout or parallel. We'll get up in just a minute and do that. Now, one other thing before we do that, before we get up. That principle that I just gave you is important only in the standing position. It's not important when you're sitting. Sit with your knees like this if you want to, but don't stand that way. That's the problem. When you're lying in constructive rest, same thing. It doesn't matter. There's no mechanical stress going through the structure with a vertical relationship to gravity. So the question comes up in your mind, well, why does he work with us in sitting in constructive rest? Because we're going to do this in constructive rest. Only for training, for practice, just so you become a technician at getting a sense of when that knee is related to the second toe. And that's the only reason. But under regular circumstances, your knees wherever you like them, and sitting and standing. Sitting and lying down. Okay, let's come to standing now, and we're going to work a little bit on this. Let's just go back for a moment to the standing idea of weight resting on the femur heads, which are between the great trochanters that melt down the sides of the legs. And the tailbone is going to lengthen down because you are resting your weight on the femur heads. Don't need to use your coccyx to support you in standing. You can let go of that if you let the weight rest on the femur heads. Right. Now, let's take the idea then with a little bounce. Then now let's relate what I just gave you about the knees over the second toes. Let's go into a plie and let the plie take you over the second toes approximately. And again, you're not going to be rigid about this because it's going to vary a little for each person, but just approximately. And then again, and then come out of the plie and do that. All right. Let me tell you what this is like. If most of you are dancers, you've had some dance training. And in some of the schools of ballet, particularly the Russian school of ballet, they work on the arms with the third finger as being the central axis around which you do your ballet movements, your arm movements. Second toe is just like that. Whatever, if you've had that kind of training, you can relate the foot to that. So that one way you could think about it, I see the second toe as an extension of the knee. It's almost as if, just as you would work with that third finger in your arms, that you do the same thing with your foot, as if you're pointing the second toe as you take a step. It's as if someone were pulling you from the tip end of the second toe to take you into movement, which will guide you with that relationship. Let's just walk around a little bit and play with this. This is not, again, something as absolute and as rigid as you might want to make it. It isn't that kind of thing, but more something you'll have to work into with a bit of kinesthesia, a bit of feeling, a bit of experience for it. So. Okay, let's come back to the standing position now. And this principle that I've given you, when we do various exercises, let's stand for a moment. I want to work a bit standing here. When we do various things, I obviously can't go over everything. What has to be done is somewhere in recesses of your consciousness, you have to have the you have to have that awareness, so that when we take up another image, you don't lose what you did here. That's difficult. What has to be done, you have to constantly condition yourself and work on these various things separately, and then integrate them into the whole of the movement that you do. I will from time to time remind you about things that we've taken up and do some reviewing, which is what I'm doing, as you see in the classes. I keep reviewing and adding and mixing in and embellishing and expanding. At any rate, this can be in the back of your mind now as you image the weight resting on your femur heads, and in particular, we talked about letting the weight drop out of the knees, which is very good also for the knees. I also mentioned that the weight of the arms could rest on the femur heads. Remember, we did arms and shoulders and different areas. So that instead of pulling the weight up into the arms, you just let them rest on the femur heads. Now what we can do is extend that a bit and imagine that someone is lifting your arms from the fingertips, but that this end of the arms, the attached end of the arms, are resting on your femur heads as they're lifted. I want you to imagine that. Now, you'll actually be lifting the arms, but imagine somebody's pulling from the fingertips the arms up, just to where you are parallel to the floor approximately. Just a very simple thing. I just want you to get in touch with that idea. And then when you've done that, you can come on back down. Now, I need to add one thing to this. Think of your central axis for a moment and let it be vertical to the floor. I mentioned that but didn't dwell on it when we took up the central axis yesterday. And you can think that for a moment. I'm going to give you now a way of getting that central axis vertical to the floor, looking at the structure, taking it apart. This is one of the most valuable means of getting that I've found. I've been using it for a long time. The xiphoid process here, watch it hanging over the pubic symphysis instead of pushing it that way. Let it hang down over the pubic symphysis. In other words, you don't want to spill your energy out that way. Doing that, well, none of you are doing that, of course. I just want to make the point here. But rather, even minutely, you don't want to do that. You want to let that hang down over the pubic symphysis. The tendency quite often is that as a person does this, that they will do that. That really breaks your energy line. We're going to be taking up the tensile forces in the body, so you want to avoid that. Now, just for a moment, let your axis be vertical to the floor. Get the sense of the xiphoid process hanging over the pubic symphysis. And now, once again, let's think of someone pulling up on the tips of the fingers and your other end of your arms resting on the femur heads. could come back down. Doing it that way, you'll feel the arm movement come through the trunk of your body. The arms are connected with the trunk of the body, with muscles that go all the way down to your waist, even below, down to your pelvis. And that helps to integrate that movement. So the arm is connected to the body. Particularly if you don't push the xiphoid process forward, just let it be quite vertical there. Okay. Now, let's extend this, not just the arms that we are going to let rest on the femur heads, but if we are going to lift up something, if I want to lift this, let me just show you here. If I keep this close to my axis, there are many ways you could do it by having it along your side, or you could straddle it and have it close to your front. If I pick this up this way, with this close to my body, there is much less weight to pick up because of the leverage effect than if I do it from here, which is the tendency of a lot of us. There, I've increased the leverage arm here. And that's hard. I'm not going to even do that because I don't want to stretch my back. But again, if I'm close to it, it becomes relatively easy. Also, a good principle here is to bend at those three joints we took up. Let them be bendable. Then you'll get the use of the deep trunk muscles, including the leg muscles, and take stress off of your back. I'd like everybody to practice picking up something, some objects around here, a bag or the edge of a bench. I chose something that was fairly heavy. It doesn't have to be too heavy, simply because you can realize in very heavy objects, but as you get more sensitive, even light objects, you'll get a sense of that. That's the idea. Keep the baby close to your body, either forward or back. Mm-hmm. That helps. Oh, the baby, yes. Keep it, same principle. Keep it close to you. And look at it from the baby's standpoint, too, not just yours. Mm-hmm. But you want to have the spine cradled in your arms so you don't put stress on the baby's spine.
What about how a lot of people do, like, hips on their hips? Back, then they stand like that.
I don't think that's so good. I think it's better either square on the front or back. On one side, I don't think so good because it throws you off center on that. That brings up the other thing now. I think you all had a go at that about carrying bags. Better to have a backpack because that centers the weight for you than a shoulder bag. A shoulder bag tends to throw the weight off center. It's on one shoulder or the other. So I would strongly urge you, if you carry a bag around, to make it a backpack. And certainly you can get backpacks to suit whatever your needs are. Even if you have very light weights to carry, you can get very small backpacks now. In fact, I've even seen book satchels, or whatever they call them, in the form of a backpack that you can just throw over your back. But that's something that's pretty important. I've seen people who've constantly had shoulder bags and they end up with one shoulder up at their ear, some sort of distortion. And what you do every day, you see, tends to build your habits. Backpacks are in order. OK. carrying the baby that you asked about, I would carry the baby either completely forward or on the back, rather than to use a side carrying object.
What about bags that are one shoulder, but you wear them on the opposite shoulder, so you go across?
I'm going to say it again now. You do what?
I think that's better.
You have two bags.
You
see?
So you wear it like this instead of on the shoulder.
Well, that's better. That's better than the other. That's better than the other, but I still feel that a backpack is better because it centers the weight. That's much better. And those are rather light bags, so it shouldn't be a lot of problems there, but, you know, still it'd be better if you had a backpack. But let me see how much weight. That's relatively a small weight. But even this, you know, you could sort of improvise that into a backpack, I think, if you wanted to. Probably doesn't look so fashionable. Doesn't look so fashionable for you, but I think it would work very well. Okay, let's see now where we are. All right, we have to move on now. All right, let's add some more axes to the two that we have. I'm going to take the axis of gravity now and remove it, any one of those, to the paper. This is the gravity axis. Now, when I talked with you about the weight of the body being borne by the spine, this is the compression weight now, and we had mentioned that it's the only compression member ultimately that connects the pelvis and the rest of the body. So the weight is going to be flowing through the spine. All of the tensile members in the upright position and the rest of the compression members are attached to the spine. So it's got a pretty heavy responsibility to transmit that weight down to the pelvis. Now, you remember when you sat on your hands, you felt that weight. It's real. It's not imaginary. The weight is real. You might want to just sit on your hands for a minute just to get in touch with that. I want it to be real for you, not just a mental trip. Sit on the hands for just a minute. Okay, now you feel that. Now, what you are feeling, I am going to represent by a line on this chart. It's the line of weight that is traveling first through your spine and then into the pelvis and then the sit bones and then down to where you're sitting there. And that line is going to be behind the axis of gravity, because the spine is slightly behind the axis of gravity. It isn't centered with it. And the weight, of course, going down, you felt that. Sit on your hands abruptly sometimes and you have no doubt about which direction the weight is going. Okay, that we'll call the compression axis. Direction is downward. It represents that weight that you just felt. Now, it was Todd's contention that the muscles of the body that we're going to give tensile support. Remember, that's when you suspend the weight instead of letting the weight rest on the structure. You're suspending the weight, pulling it up, as it were, as this hook is doing. She maintained that the muscles in the front of the body up to the cardinal coronal plane were the ones that should be used mostly for tensile purposes, as opposed to the muscles in the back. And she expressed the collective action of these muscles serving as tensile members. She expressed them as a tensile axis. And she put that slightly in front on the axis of gravity. And its direction is upward. Tensile, write it down. And compression in opposite directions, and they should be equal to balance. What you have then is tensile force and compression force playing around the central axis to keep you upright. And that balance is not static again, but it's dynamic. It's happening moment to moment to moment, which is another reason why we should not think in terms of the standing position or any position, sitting, even lying, as being static, as being frozen in space. It's a balance that's constantly recaptured moment to moment to moment. Now, I want to just try to elucidate further what Todd is saying. She's saying that we don't need to give the structure here in back tensile support by pulling up with these muscles, because you've got compression members to give you that support. This bench, for instance, you don't need to suspend this bench from the ceiling there to support it, because it's being supported on the floor, which is a compression member. You don't need to do that. You could. You'd have a kind of a hammock affair. You don't need to do that. Now, she's saying that you don't need to do that back here because you've got the compression members here doing that for you. But that you do need some support in front, because you don't have any compression members going down to the pelvis the way the spine does. So you remember we said the spine was the only compression member going down to the pelvis to give you support. If your sternum went down to your pubic symphysis, then you would have compression support here, and our whole beings would be entirely different. We'd be more like a tortoise. Well, we'd be very stable, but we'd be very awkward and clumsy and slow. Wouldn't be able to move around very fast. I'd like to see somebody dance with a double spine. Okay. So it's the muscles in here that need to pull up, balancing this compression support back here. She also, in her thinking about this, maintained that not only do you not need the support back here, the tensile support, but that if you attempt to give it by pulling up through here, that you unseat the balance of the compression support. That is, you pull up on this, it's like toppling it, tending to topple it over. So, here is what we come up with from that information as an image to work to cultivate that idea. We think up the front of the spine to activate the tensile members and down the back. Now you've had the down the back with the dropping of the spinous processes. That's what that was all about, to help teach you not to use the muscles back here as tensile members, that is, not to pull the spinous processes up, but to let them drop, which means you would release the muscles back there that you were using as tensile members. The real problem in this work is not that. You can learn to do that after a little practice. But in the standing position to get the tensile members working, because standing in the upright position, sitting too, you can't let go back here really until you got more work happening in front, which will support the upright position, because you do need some support. So you're not going to get something for nothing out of this work. It's not going to be a total relaxation process. There ain't no free lunches, folks. You got to be some energy used somewhere to be upright. It's efficient, and it might feel very easy, and sometimes feels as if you're doing nothing, but there always is some work. That's why Swigart, as I told you, used to get so annoyed when people thought of her work as relaxation. And I told you how she'd get apoplectic, really foaming at the mouth. Look, I wouldn't want to even be in the same room with that woman when she got furious with this thing. And this is why, because this relaxation is not what the work is really. It's an element of it, but it certainly isn't the focus of it. As I said, I don't mind if you do use it for relaxation. That's fine. Whatever your purposes are, fine. Okay, so now we're going to work a little bit with the idea of thinking up the front of the spine and down the back. And we're going to do that on the floor, too. But let's come up to standing now, and let's work with the image. Barbara and I call this image the cycle. The cycle. It's like a bicycle chain. You go up the front and down the back. Some people say, well, what happens first? Does it come down the back first, or do you go up the front first? It's a bicycle chain. It's all happening at the same time. Now, it's true you may need to, depending upon your own patterns, you might find it more beneficial to think down the back first or to think up the front, and certainly adjust to that. Let's use our hands for tactile aid for a moment, and then we're going to work with partners, where you slide your hand up the front wall of the body and think up the front, and then take the hand a little above you as you think down the back. And then let's do the same thing again with the other hand, just to get a sense of the up the front and the down the back. Notice, when you run your fingers up the front wall of the body, you are out here. If possible, think on the front of the spine. Think behind the sternum. That rose has thorns. Okay. Think up the front of the spine, up the front, under the sternum. And what we're going to do now is to take partners, and we're going to do this. Just stand over here for a second with your side to the class. And you are going to do your tactile leg going up the front, and at the same time I'm going down the back. But wait a minute, I want to show the class where I am. If you run your fingers down the cervical spine, you'll come to a very long process at the base of the neck. That's usually the seventh cervical. So I'm going to do that with my partner. And from there, I'm going to go down the back. Okay. Do that one more time. I want to complete the cycle with tactile A, that's why. Take partners for just a moment. Do that a couple of times on each side and then change over and your partner will help you. Got a partner, Lee? Okay. As you bring your arm above your head, remember to let the xiphoid process point down to the pubic symphysis. Now that you, yeah.
How deep are you imagining either the front side to be? Are you right along the spine or are you in the front of the body?
I would just think of it going up the front of the spine, and you can be actually anywhere between the front of the spine and the back of the sternum.
You could even be behind the central axis.
No. The central axis is on the front of the spine, actually. No, you're not going to be behind this, not behind the central axis. Central axis in a good alignment will touch the, go through the centers of the curves.
Even in the thoracic spine?
Beg pardon?
Even in the thoracic spine?
Oh, I see what you're saying, yeah. You would if you followed it religiously, but I don't want you to think behind the central axis in your thinking. It's better to think up the front of the spine without thinking behind the central axis. Yeah, in the thoracic it is, you're right, it's behind there. You would be behind it. Because actually, later on I'm going to use the central axis. We'll just think that of moving up. But Todd talked in terms of thinking of the